a good song.
Why is good protection start. So important good start. In your life?
You've probably picked the strangest song of the whole book, to be honest with you. The one with with least relevance, I guess. It was just when I was traveling around America after I left university, it was the... I only had a CD player and I didn't have any money, so I couldn't buy any more CDs. And you know, this is back in the day when... It's funny now. In fact, my runner the other day, a fellow called Harry, lambasted me for having, an iPhone 4. And it just made me think... And I said to him, but it's an iPhone. He said, yeah, but it's an iPhone 4. And sort of walked away from me like I was some sort of granddad.
Yeah, exactly.
And I may as well have been holding it like a Discman. And the Discman was what got me around America. And Massive Attack Protection was one of the only CDs I had.
And kids, for those kids listening, a Discman was the equivalent kind of a portable CD with headphones.
Man, I mean, that just, when you put it like that, it just makes you feel so antiquated, doesn't it?
Listen, I just did play a piece of music there. One of the reasons is that you start off each chapter and go into each detail of, and why wouldn't you? Because the book is actually called The Soundtrack to My Life.
Yeah.
And is that the way you want to do it? Like, this is not just an autobiography at this stage of your career.
Yeah.
It is more to do with what the music might have meant and then the stories lead through that.
Sort of. I mean, I got offered to do a biography and I wasn't really planning on writing anything like that for another few years. And then I just thought, you know, I'd give it a go and see what happens. But I didn't want to do a kind of like a, oh, this is me sort of biog, you know? So, I've worked in sort of television for the last 15 years and a lot of that to do with me in radio and a lot of that sort of based around music. And then music being an important part of my life anyway. I just thought, well, if we tag it to something.
Yeah.
And, hold my hand up and say, it's not the first time that's been done, you know? And from a fiction point of view, Nick Hornby does it so well in High Fidelity. But I just wanted to gauge the chapters or channel rather the chapters through something, and music was the perfect opportunity.
For the simple reason, the music is so important.
And
in your life.
Well, yeah, but also it's such a music for all of us. I think is such a trigger to experiences.
Yeah.
So I think if I'd have sat down and just tried to write, I don't think I'd have had, because I don't make a journal or do a diary or anything like that. So it's all just quite anecdotal and quite stream of consciousness. And I don't think, in retrospect, I've never really thought about this until you asked the question. I don't think I'd have actually written the book I'd have written and had the memories I'd had I not had the music and the single, the singles that I bought not triggered it.
And the music is the springboard for the book, the springboard for the story, and it basically is the springboard for so many things in our lives.
Yeah,
anyway.
Exactly.
So why not? Okay, so there is one description here. The rugby playing James Joyce reading Arsenal fan. can I just get...
I didn't describe myself as
no. No. Hold on a second. The James Joyce bit. Are you trying to tell me you've read Ulysses more than once?
No, in fact, Ulysses is one of three books I haven't finished because I got... You know when you read a book sometimes you get lost in the middle of it and you go, it's all right, I'll go back three pages. Yeah. And you go back three pages and then realise I was still lost and I was halfway through it and I was trapped in this maze. Yeah. Oh, no, I mean, literally, I can't get out of it. No. But I've done Finnegan's Wake, done Dubliners.
You've done Finnegan's Wake.
I know.
What?
I know.
I am going to try Finnegan's Wake once, but first I just want to finish the internet. Seriously, Finnegan's Wake. Wow, you got there.
A long time ago.
I'm very impressed.
I was a young man, you know.
Okay, well, they might as well go for the young man bit then. I mean, growing up not that far from London, therefore influenced by a lot of what was happening in London.
I think so, yeah. I think the thing is, we were up in London every weekend, pretty much. My dad, we were either watching my... Or I was watching my dad play hurling. He played for a kind of a diaspora team called the Father Murphys, who were a Wexford team, and then they were very much a Wexford team as well. And so I'd either go up and watch him in Ruislip or New Elton, which is where they played at the time as well, or we'd be up in the sort of that, you know, that classic kind of northwest London enclave that still exists now, but at the time in the 70s and 80s was absolutely thriving, Kilburn, Queen's Park and so forth. So London was a big influence on me, and Irish London was a huge influence on me.
Okay, Irish London being a huge influence on you to the extent that, first of all, like your dad, as you say, Wexford hurler, came over with 30 quid in his pocket, and like he done good, that lad. So many ways, because he went to night school, he did his stuff, his study, and then he became whatever it was, an engineer at BT.
He worked for BT and he ended up being sort of deputy head of their accounts in the UK, and he did really, really well, my dad, and I'm very proud of him.
So does Dermot O'Leary get the work ethic from the dad, do you think?
My mum's the engine room, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a classic thing.
I read the book.
Exactly. So, you know, the dad might be out, you know, making the dough, but the mum's a sergeant major making sure everything happens at home.
Okay, so let's just take it then, like, in terms of school, in terms of whatever you did afterwards, in terms of going to, did you want to always end up doing what it is that you're doing now?
Well, I thought I did, Dave, but I didn't. It's that thing where you never really know until you do it. You have an idea what it's going to be like, and it really isn't anything like the idea you think it's going to be like. But I knew I wanted to talk for a living in some way, shape or form, and I thought, but it, you know, not beyond my wildest dreams, I thought I'd end up where I have. I thought I'd, if I was being realistic with you, I thought I might, you know, I wanted to be a producer, a live producer. And I didn't know whether that was going to be in television or radio or in politics or in, you know, political show or in current affairs, let's say, or in entertainment. I got the bug working in television quite quickly. And of course, I wanted to be front of camera or behind the mic, but I never banked that would happen, so I made sure that I got my apprenticeship behind, you know, behind the screens and so forth. Because, and anyway, even if it was going to happen, I wanted that kind of, I wanted that stability. I wanted, I didn't want to just be a show pony, you know, and something I sort of, without meaning to be too introspective, that's something I sort of brought pride myself on, that I wanted to be, write scripts, do research, all those things, you know.
Right. Yeah, but the same token, I mean, like, this business of what you do now on television, etc., and like the way you are front of camera and the way you are the most, like, in terms of the biggest program on television, you're presenting it every single week, the last 7 or 8 years or whatever. Yeah. Having said that, you would like to move on at some stage, possibly to do something else. You've done your kids' question time. Would you like to go on to the main one?
I don't think so. I mean, I definitely want.
What you really want is what Jonathan Ross had about 5 or 6 times. About 15, 16 years ago. Terry Wogan had 2, 3 or 4 chat shows, as in like they do in America. It's every day.
Yeah, I'd love that eventually. But I won't feel, you know, our culture at the moment in Britain is for a comedian to do a talk show, and I'm not a comedian, so I wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to go to my sort of light entertainment grave and kicking and screaming if that doesn't ever happen. It's just something I'd like to, you know, I love talking to people. It's what I do best. I like interviewing people. I'm interested in people, and I think you can find commonality with most people, and I really, really enjoy the process of that. And so, yeah, obviously, that's something I'd love to do. I never like a broadcaster to talk down to people, so I love the idea of, you know, why can't you speak to a politician, or why can't you speak to someone about Ebola, why can't you speak to someone about the deficit, and then also have someone on, you know, who's you know, promoting a book.
It's always a conversation and not an interview. So, like, the point of it is that one of the offshoots of the success that you've had over the past bunch of years is that you're a bit of a style icon, as in, like, a huge way, and you're proud of it to a point as well. Like, you once said that yourself and Mr. Take That on the programme, that the two of you, like, really kept it up there. Like, that you weren't just wearing suits, you were wearing good suits.
Nothing more than a show pony. But if you know, if you're going to get a good budget for suits, then make sure you get nice suits, right? It's a nice thing to dress well, and but God, you know, I mean, you know, I don't take, I'm certainly no style icon.
Really?
No.
That's not what I hear. All right, okay, fair enough. I mean, you used to wear the football gear, of course, years ago. How's Arsenal doing these days? It's kind of,
we are, yes,
not too good.
Weird.
Not too good the other week there in Europe, eh?
God, yeah, I was there as well. It was an absolute smash and grab. I felt how I felt for them, how we felt when Liverpool mugged us at the FA Cup a few years ago, in that we didn't deserve anything out of that game, and then suddenly we had 2 goals in the last 10 minutes. Although, I have to tell you, the police told us on the way over, we got the Eurostar over to Brussels, and we were on the same train as the Everton fans, because they were going, they were playing away at Lille, and the police said, "Do you want to watch yourself in Brussels?" And said, "Really, Brussels?" And he said, "Yeah, got quite a tasty firm in Brussels, and you know, and we don't really, you know, we speak to our counterparts over there. They don't really police the area, and so it's pretty lawless." Me and my friends are looking at each other, going, "Brussels." I mean, part of the reason why we were going is Mools, Fritz, nice few beers, very relaxing. We got there, got out of the cab, and we sort of looked up and we were like, "Lille." Cheeky, because it was essentially like Hampstead. And it was just this kind of beautiful area where it was just the most genteel part of Brussels.
And have you been following Arsenal, like, with away games quite a lot comes with years?
Yeah, we try. Me and some friends, we try and do, the guys I sit with at home, try and do one away game a year, and try and do one European trip as well. We've had some terrible beatings, but some good trips and some good dinners. You juxtapose, you know, losing to Milan 4-0 with a really quite a delicious supper.
Yeah, absolutely. And why not? Okay, I'm going to play another piece of music, because we want to get back to the book, as in it is the soundtrack to your life, which is the title, the soundtrack to my life, Dermot O'Leary. This is Gimme Shelter with the Rolling Stones. the Rolling Stones is what it is, Dermot.
You picked some good tracks.
Why you've give done me shelter well. From the
you
Rolling
could have,
Stones?
You could have stitched me up today quite badly, I tell you.
Don't worry, I might still mention the Macarena is there.
Yeah. That's the premise of the book is that you don't necessarily pick the soundtrack.
Yeah, exactly,
it picks you. So these kind of counterpoints, songs in your life are kind of almost thrust upon you. And you, so you're doing well if they're good. That one is good. And that was my mixtape song. So this guy, Rob Morgan, who I went to university with, was the first guy to sort of properly get me into the Stones, because I was born in 73, so really, growing up, for me, the Beatles and the Stones were almost history.
A previous generation, Okay, so from there, with all this music here, I might as well go to that first one. I did mention the Macarena, but I have to mention the Brendan Shine one that opens
that's
up.
That's me if you come, my name is Dan, and I'm your man.
Do you know, I once played that on the programme as we were talking about earworms, about things that just get stuck in your you can't get. And Brendan Shine was coming back from the airport and he rang up.
Did he?
Yeah, he said, I can't believe you're playing my song.
So Brendan Shine was touring back in, when I was, must have been 7, 8, 9, something like that. And he was... one of the songs that we would listen to quite a lot, and I don't know how, but we got the 7-inch and so forth of that, and You Want Your Old Lobby Washed Down. Yeah. So then for my birthday, he was playing, I think, in Chelmsford Civic Centre, which is about 30 miles away from where I grew up, and my parents got tickets, and it was the most exciting moment of my life. But it was the first...
You fell asleep, folks.
I fell asleep. I was 8 years old, and I fell asleep in that very 8-year-old way on two very uncomfortable... plastic orange chairs. I remember it distinctly.
But you went backstage.
And I woke up. Exactly. I woke up and I was distraught. And my dad, bless him, picked me up and wormed his way backstage and got me the intro to Brendan. I just remember this sweaty guy come off to a great set and sort of patted me on the head and signed an autograph. And I was so happy.
I think they have a backstage pass at Brendan Shine.
I don't know how my dad got me back there. I say in the book, he was the most charming Irishman in a room full of Irishmen, which took something.
Yeah, right, indeed. I know, it's a piece, like, there is an awful lot of the Irish thing with you, of course. And, like, it's not as though you ever were here, like, on
it's
holidays.
It's funny, really. It's a very, very different upbringing to someone who's brought up and born and brought up over here. But it's quite hard, I think, for a lot of Irish people to understand how distinct and how rich and how ingrained it is in that second generation that have spent a lot of time in London in a very Irish household in a very Irish area, and then you come over here pretty much for these endless summers that we used to come over where you would literally be sent to your grandmother's and you'd be there for weeks on end. And it's funny, you know, you always get it when you come back, is that, you know, you do get that kind of but it is what it is, you know. I'm a child of two fathers, and you know, I'm proud of it.
Yeah, and on that note, the Pogues would probably seem to me, looking through the book, to be the biggest influence on your life.
100%.
The best music.
100%. I mean,
gig in Brixton.
Yeah, well, I grew up with Springsteen. I listened to Springsteen a lot, but then obviously I've got to see Springsteen since. But there's obviously a slight disconnect in the sense that, you know, he's an American from New Jersey.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Pogues are the band, I think, that... And I suppose the Smiths to a degree, but the Pogues in particular were a band that kind of properly ticked the... clicked inside me, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because they were... All the music I love listening to and was brought up listening to, which is kind of folk and a bit of rock and even a bit of punk. And yet they spoke... They had these kind of cultural reference points that... that only someone Irish could properly understand. So, you know, a lot of the stuff I've been brought up, my dad brought me up with a lot of Irish literature and a lot of Irish history and a lot of Irish politics. And none of it was coloured with that much opinion. It was just, you know, you have to be aware of this. And he didn't have to force anything down my neck because I'm a politics and a history junkie. So, you know, I soaked it all up. And the Pogues were, you know, that, you know, Frank Ryan brought you whiskey in a bottle in Madrid. You know, these kind of, like, out of nowhere you get these reference points with the Pogues. And it was the first proper gig I went to on my own up in London, Brixton Academy, with my mate Tom Curry, who'd studied up in London. He got us tickets and we went down. To this day, it's the most exciting gig I've ever been to.
Mainlining the music, as you
yeah,
brought
exactly.
It really was.
Exactly that,
And curled up with some drunk at the end.
Some old biker or something with a leather jacket on.
The funny thing is, like, about all of that, do you find that you have to kind of, what's the word for it, excuse the music on The X Factor because of just what you've so passionately talked about?
You know, when we first started the show, it's interesting, because when we first started a show, what I did find quite uncomfortable, and I've said this before, is that when people would turn up to the show and say, I'll be what you want me to be, tell me who you want me to be, and I'll be it.
Yeah.
And there's a trigger about 5 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, where people started turning up and saying, here's my YouTube channel. I see this show as a vehicle for me. This is how I see my first album. I write songs. And suddenly the sort of show turned on its head. And a part of me thinks, it doesn't matter because the show's an entertainment show. And I think, and pop in many ways is fun and shouldn't be taken that seriously. And we need a sort of chin stroke and you know, why can't I love doing this great entertainment show and also like credible music as well? But I think the lines are blurred now, because I think that you look at some of the artists that the show has had sort of helped to create, and people that have gone, and just bear in mind, the show almost, like, I always say to them, your hard work starts when the show finishes. Then you're out on your own, and then it's about whether you can find a good writer to work with, and whether you can survive in this industry and sell records and whatnot. And the show, I think, is I get quite angry about it. There's an awful lot of snobbery attached to the X Factor, and people, you know, and I think, why shouldn't someone who has grafted all their life, but the stars haven't aligned for them, why shouldn't someone who is a secretary and Hackney want to have the dream to be a singer, and she's got a great voice, so why shouldn't she? And she won it, and she's Leona Lewis. You know, I think we can chin stroke to our heart's content, but there's a great deal of snobbery about it.
But maybe you should allow some of the snobbery as well. So the snobbery feels it as much as everything else does. I mean, like, this is the thing that's in the tabloids all throughout the summer, or all throughout the time it isn't even on the telly, let alone it is on the telly.
I know.
Two or three pages all the time.
You know, if it's talked about, then. As far as the Boskins are concerned, that's a good thing.
I mean, there was a point at one stage when the only two people left were you and Louis Walsh, and everybody else was gone, from Kate Thornton to Danny to Cheryl, etc.
There was one year when Simon went to America that me and Louis, I was just, man, we were staring down a gun. we were staring down the barrel. But Louis, I'm sure you've met Louis in your time, and Louis does a great job of playing the Egypt, but he's absolutely sharp as a button when he wants to be.
He's lasted into double figures. This will be my last year.
He sort of knows what he's doing and he doesn't know what he's doing at exactly the same time.
Yeah, what about the American one, the American X Factor? I mean, you were definitely disappointed, publicly disappointed.
You said it straight out. Absolutely.
Because you thought, that you should have got it, could have got it? The guy who did get it, by the way, lasted a year.
I never thought I should have got it. I would never presume that, but I would like to have got it and had a crack at it and would have like to think I could have made a success out of it. And also it's a different place to work, and I fancied, and still do in many ways, going over to work there. And I've been offered a couple of shows there subsequently, but my sort of litmus test is, well, if I wouldn't do it in Britain, then there's no reason as to why I should do it in America. And obviously, I love the X Factor, and I never wanted to give the UK one up. I just had this naive thought that I could fly between two countries and do it within a week.
You do have a thing in the book about live television on a Sunday morning, whatever it was, with Beth Orton and all the rest, which is how slow and painful it all goes. Yeah, just it has to happen. I mean, this now live, it's probably the biggest show that British television has ever put on, certainly on a weekly basis, in terms of just the huge production, the huge money. You're the centre of it all.
It's definitely up there. I mean, it's in many ways, the show, the book's kind of what it's like to work on Big Brother and X Factor, and whether people like them or not, they're two of the biggest shows that the country's made, and two of the kind of the shows that sort of changed the way television's made as well in the last 10 years. So, yeah, I've got a lot of pride working on both of those shows and working with the people that worked on those shows. But X Factor definitely was a game changer, because with Big Brother, it had kind of, it rated well back home, but it had a kind of a polarising effect on people, whereas with The X Factor, it still does, but with The X Factor, it's, we sort of regularly, certainly, that One Direction year, I remember getting, regularly getting 15, 16, 17 million people watching the show. And the way they do the ratings now is kind of, it's a little bit skewed, because people watch it, but they watch it during the week.
Yeah.
I knew it was a big step up, but even then I knew it was a big step up, and then it wasn't the show it is now.
But I mean, going to meet Simon and you go out with Jerry Springer at the same time and all that. I mean, you knew was this something that you felt you had to get, even with your jet lag as you arrived in LA or whatever, or just you can only just be who you are?
Well, I got the job up until, but if the boss doesn't sign you off, then you haven't got the job, So I had to fly over to America and spend a few days with him. But I just thought, you have to be yourself. You can't go out there and pretend to be someone else. And also, the great thing about Simon, I always defend him on this to the Hill is that he hates a yes man. He loves people not necessarily to challenge him for the sake of challenging him, but he wants people to have their own minds and work within a team. And if, yeah, he's still the boss, but he's not. If you just agree with everything you say, then what's the point of it? And that was never really me. So we went out and we got on well, but it was a very surreal experience going out there, because he has this thing. He does, and I know it's such a cliche, but he does have that kind of walk in a room kind of feeling about him. And Jimmy Carr, who's his good friend, said, and Jimmy has no professional allegiance or affiliation with Simon whatsoever. He's a very successful stand-up. He doesn't need a gig from Simon at all. And he said that I was with him in a room and Simon walked in and Jimmy felt like he wanted to stand up and salute. He has that.
So where does it go from here with you in terms of X Factor? Do you just know year by year then?
I sit down I have a good vibe in my head as to whether I want to do it again about this time of year. I think so long as I'm enjoying it and I'm still getting a lot out of it, I want to carry on doing it. I'd never want to do it if it ever felt stale or if it ever felt too complacent. I feel very comfortable, but I don't feel complacent. And so long as I'm enjoying it, I want to do it. And then it's up to them as to whether they want me to host it or not.
Okay, Irish-wise, in terms of those influences besides your parents, of course, we mentioned the Pogues. You go back to 8 for Brendan Shine. Stay at 8 for somebody on TV, Terry Wogan, who we mentioned earlier on.
Yeah.
What was it about Terry Wogan when you were very young?
Was ours. That was the thing. I was brought up in a household where it was a strange upbringing in the sense of it was an Irish household in the middle of a semi-rural Britain. So there was a picture of the Pope, we went to Mass every week. We then saw lots of Irish people after Mass. We went for dinner with them. We'd probably end up back at our house. We'd have a little kind of impromptu little Cayley or a Hooley or whatever. So therefore, Terry was pretty much the only signpost in mass media for my family that I suppose to cling on to. And so he was on the radio every day. And then we got tickets when my Uncle Frank retired. He worked for the LEB, which was London Electricity Board. He was an electrician, and then he retired. And like a lot of men when they retire, he got a bit bored, and then he wanted to do something else. So he got a job as a security guard at the Shepherd's Bush Television Theatre, which I don't think is there anymore. In fact, no, it's not there anymore, but it's a beautiful old building. And he got us tickets to Wogan. So we came up from Colchester and we saw this show, and it was there. It was when I got the bug. And Terry even walked past and stopped beside me and my mum and my auntie Angela, and he signed an autograph, and my mum held his glass of wine, which I remember to this day thinking, is he going to drink that wine, because it's going on television in a minute? And that's where I suppose that's where the where I just went, well, this is it was like crack. I walked in and just went, this is the catnip. This is what I want to do,
and this is what you want to do, this is what you are doing. But like, the future might be that you will actually do what he once did for a while, which was four.
I hope so, but it's a weird thing. If somebody had told me I'd be doing the X Factor, 8 years ago, I would have laughed in your face, I never thought I got offered it. So it's that thing where you plan, but you can never really plan. So for example, this show this year, in March, fell on my lap to go to Houston and hook up with the International Space Station, and we did this live show on Channel 4 for 2.5 hours, and it was beautiful. It's one of the most exhilarating things I've ever done. And even when I read it, I thought, if we get 50% of this access, we'll be doing well. We got 100% of it. And NASA were unbelievable. We hooked up with the International Space Station. It lapped the planet. It was extraordinary. We were able to talk to astronauts and ask them to zoom in on the Andes. And if you'd have told me I'd have been doing that, two weeks before I got off
of course.
It.
Yeah,
of
course.
So I develop all the time, and I've got ideas and so forth. And I've got the radio, which is a big passion.
Yeah,
as
radio
well.
on Radio 2, BBC on Saturday afternoons. But also, just finally, just like this business of like the other people that were there. I mean, when the Kate Thorntons, when the Dannys, when the Cheryls get sacked and that, I mean, it seems to, there's a lot of rancor, there's a lot of bad vibes in that. Is it all just part of the whole little thing? And do you step back from that? I mean, you have been dragged in now and again.
Yeah,
you
I think for me, listen, if they don't want
Kate Thornton was not happy.
No, I mean, and it was hard for me because Kate's a friend, so it was hard to get offered her a job off the back of it. But I called her, and she was very cool, very, very cool about me taking it, and was a complete lady. So it's difficult because in one respect you miss, like, Nicole Scherzinger's not on the show anymore. Nicole was one of the best judges we've ever had. I sort of miss working with her. But the dynamic changes every year with the judges. And I think that with those sort of judges, it sort of has to also, it's not like she was sacked. It just happens. It's a far more it's a far more respectful process than I think it comes across on you know, in the papers or whatnot.
It comes across like a cat fight in the papers, which probably is the best thing for us in terms of the programme. Just stand well back. All right, listen, Dermot, thank you very much. I get the impression that this here that I have in my hand, the soundtrack to my life, is chapter one, or certainly part one. There'll be a part two when you're 80, maybe?
I hope so.
By the way, did you get down on your knees in that one knee, in that restaurant in Manhattan?
No, I didn't. In fact, it was this terrible moment where we were crossing the street and I said to myself, I went to New York to propose to my wife and she was working out there. And I was crossing the street and my flight was late, that was it. And I was going to ask him in the hotel. And then I just thought, you know, I just feel it. And just when it feels right, just ask him. We're crossing the street and I looked up and I saw the Chrysler Building. We were sort of downtown in the Bowery. And I saw the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building. And it was magical. It was where we first sort of, it was our first big trip away together years ago. And I thought, right, now's the moment. And so I said, you know, will you marry me? And she looked up and she just said, well, here. You're asking me here. And of course, I realised I've got this incredible view of the woman I love. And these guys
turn around, Dee.
And she's literally looking behind me at a real estate office and two waste paper bins outside. So I literally did exactly that. I sort of turned around and went, ta-da! She was like, oh, I get it. Yes, by the way, I will.
And so far, happily ever after. We'll find out from number two how happily it worked out. Okay, thank you very much, Dermot O'Leary.
Don't tempt fate.
Good man yourself, Dermot. Thank you very much indeed. The soundtrack to my life is the name of the book itself, and I may as well, I presume, will it be Streams of Whiskey if I play something now from Pogues?
Brilliant.
Okay, the Pogues, Streams of Whiskey,
thanks,
here it is. Come on, Dermot.